Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. Today, I'll be talking with Carrie Moss from the Michigan Civil Liberties Union and Elizabeth Wydra from the Constitutional Accountability Center. I will also be saying goodbye. Today is the last regular Lynn Rivers Show, and we will spend it, as we have so many others, on the Constitution of the United States. Two issues front and center in election year politics are health care reform and gay marriage. Today, we'll be talking about both these issues with an eye to the constitutional relationship between the states and the federal government. The president says that when it comes to gay marriage, the states should lead, yet the Affordable Care Act trumps the states. So, when do the states choose and when can the government direct? When the framers built the Constitution, they chopped power into little bitty pieces, hoping to keep authority out of the hands of one individual or a small group. In their genius, they divided power horizontally into the three branches of the federal government, but also vertically between the states and the national government. Federalism. This division is not always clear, and history gives many examples of both governments claiming power over a single issue. Today, we'll look at the debate around who has the power when it comes to health care and the definition and recognition of marriage. Joining me today are Carrie Moss and Elizabeth Wydra. Carrie is the director of the Michigan Civil Liberties Union, and Elizabeth is chief counsel at the Constitutional Accountability Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome to both of you. It's nice to talk with you again.
Lynn, thank you. This is Carrie. Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor. I just want to say what a pleasure it's been to have your show on the air for all this time, and what a great job you've done.
Thank you, Carrie.
And I completely agree with Carrie. It's always wonderful to be with you, and it's particularly a delight to be with you and an honor to be with you on your last show, which will be sorely missed.
All right. Well, thank you so much, but let's get to it. We've talked on this show and in other instances about federalism, but just to give people sort of a refresher, Elizabeth, I'm going to turn to you. When we talk about federalism, what do we mean?
Yeah, so, you know, federalism is generally used to describe the allocation of power between the federal government and the states. And so under our Constitution, the federal government has powers that are delegated to it in the text of the Constitution. And so we think of the government, the federal government, as one of enumerated powers that are listed in the Constitution. Yes, and then there's the sort of residual power, also sort of commonly talked about, a general police power, that remains in the states or, as the Constitution says, with the people. So that power is not really enumerated. That's much broader. And so while the federal government would need to sort of point to something in the Constitution that gives it a certain power, the states don't have to do that. Of course, they still have to respect the rights of the people that are set forth in the Constitution, so that's a limitation on the states, obviously. But the states generally have much greater discretion in certain matters, certainly not all, because the powers delegated to the federal government are significant, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Right.
But that's generally what we talk about when we're talking about federalism.
Right. Now, Carrie, under the 14th Amendment, we start out at the very beginning, and there's some dispute about whether the Bill of Rights, some of these fundamental freedoms, whether they apply to the states. And early on, the Supreme Court says no. But then in 1868, we get the 14th Amendment. And that has been widely seen as doing what with the Bill of Rights relative to the states?
Well, it completely empowered the entire what we now think of as the civil rights movement, because until that happened, essentially the Constitution was not enforceable. And as a practical matter, it really wasn't until the 1920s or so, when the ACLU was formed, the NAACP was formed, the cases were even filed trying to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. And it completely transformed both state and federal law.
Right. So we get this turning point around the 14th Amendment. You get the changes in the language. Now it says no state can do these certain things. So we get then in the early 1900s, that's the beginning of sort of the sort of the genesis of groups like the American Civil Liberties Union?
Well, I certainly wasn't a cause and effect. I would actually say that it wasn't. And those groups, I mean, in the ACLU in particular, evolved out of government repressive activities, particularly around the effort to distribute information around contraception. and also efforts at unionization. And it was as those issues kind of played out that kind of creative lawyers started really trying to use the courts to enforce the 14th Amendment.
Okay, so you talk about unions and these kinds of social changes that were taking place in the early 1900s. Elizabeth, during that time, was the national government more of a power for the individual, or was the federal government operating as a bad actor in this? In other words, as people were looking to organize labor unions, as they were looking for more progressive treatment, all kinds of things, was the federal government leading the charge? Were the states, or was nobody helping people?
Well, it's obviously, you know, it's a mixed bag on many of these points. And, you know, the 14th Amendment passed right after the Civil War was, you know, revolutionized federalism under our Constitution, making the provisions of the Bill of Rights, like freedom of religion, you know, very important rights about free speech, the right to assemble, which also has to deal with unionization. It applied those protections against state measures, because prior to that, many states were not held responsible for violations of these key rights. In the South, we had a lot of abolitionists getting criminally punished despite their First Amendment rights to free speech. And so, you know, after the 14th Amendment was passed, the federal government did pass some laws, some civil rights laws that protected these new constitutional rights against state infringement. But, you know, of course, there's also evidence of the federal government sort of not fulfilling that promise. And we all know that, you know, sort of the promise of the 14th Amendment, it's equal protection and the idea that all people are entitled to due process, really was not, the promise of that was not really fulfilled until we had some of these movements in the 20th century that sort of got the federal government, spurred the federal government to action, and got some of the most important pieces of legislation passed, like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 1965.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show. You're listening to us here on 89.1 WEMU, and today we are talking about federalism, states' rights, national efforts toward human rights and civil liberties. My guests are Carrie Moss from the Michigan Civil Liberties Union and Elizabeth Weidrich from the Constitutional Accountability Center. Just briefly, I want to go back to you for a minute, Elizabeth. As you look at sort of the major changes over the 20th century, things like unionization, things like civil rights, voting rights for women, any number of things, the change in our perception of privacy around sexual attitudes, Roe v. Wade, would those things, in your estimation, would those things have occurred if it had been left solely to the states?
It's hard to say. You know, certainly some states gave women access to the ballot box before the federal government did with the amendment process. But, you know, I think what's important to recognize about sort of the decision to make some of these issues in some cases, like voting rights for women, constitutional issues, is that these were issues that the country, we the people, decided were so important that they wouldn't be subject either to a vote by the states or a vote even in Congress, that some of these things were so important, like equality, like the right to vote, that they wouldn't be up for sort of debate. They would be enshrined in our Constitution as fundamental rights. And I think, you know, to a similar degree, these federal laws like the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, and many gender equality statutes, they say that, look, these things are so important to our nation's march of progress in terms of promoting equal opportunity and fundamental dignity and equality of all people, that they aren't going to be left up to the states, and that Congress is going to say our entire country subscribes to the constitutional ideas that all people deserve equal protection of the laws and due process of the laws. And so I think that it's very important that it was done nationally pursuant to the Constitution's text and history.
Carrie, I want to turn to you because we want to talk a little bit about gay marriage, or actually a lot about gay marriage. It's now in the news because the president has come out in favor of it. But he says the states should lead. Now, there are a number of cases in courts around the country. We've had some very high-profile cases like Proposal 8 out in California. That case is now in front of, or has been recently handled in a federal court in California, I believe. And that court has interpreted, I mean, you probably know this better than I, but my understanding is that court has said, look, under the Equal Protection Law, the ban on gay marriage in California is unconstitutional. Do you think that we are headed for some sort of Supreme Court decision on this, or is it going to keep getting bounced back to the states?
Well, I think it's just a matter of time before this is a non-issue. When you look at public polls and, you know, the under 40 crowd does not understand what all the fuss is about. So eventually this is going to resolve itself. Eventually it's going to require a federal solution because there are so many benefits associated with marriage that are driven by federal law. So it's hard to say yet how it will play out. I mean, I want to really agree with a lot of what Elizabeth was just saying and the idea that on certain issues, it is necessary for the federal government to speak, that a failure to speak has many problems, one of which is that the states are so fractured that, you know, chaos of sorts can ensue. So unless the federal government speaks, preferably through the Supreme Court, eventually it will be crazy if marriage is allowed in one state and not in another, and people can adopt in one state and not in another, and how that gets managed as, you know, children assert their rights to inheritance and to various benefits from estates and adoption. It will just really be a mess, and that will eventually have to get settled.
Well, Elizabeth, I want to turn to you about a constitutional provision that doesn't often come up in this debate. We talk a lot about equal protection, but in Section 4 of the Constitution, there are obligations that states have to one another, and one of them is that they have to respect the law and the judicial proceedings from other states. So how can the federal law on this, DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, how can the federal law relieve Michigan of having to recognize Massachusetts laws relative to marriage? In other words, the federal law purports to say that Michigan doesn't have to recognize legal marriages from the state of Massachusetts. Is that a unique approach to this, or is there something that the federal government has a right to do in that case?
Well, it is very problematic, as you mentioned. What we call the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution requires that other states recognize the validity of legal acts consummated in another state. And, you know, I think that this gets back to your question about whether the marriage equality issue is going to get before the Supreme Court sooner rather than later. And I think it's probably going to be sooner, precisely because there are challenges to DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, that I think are probably going to be headed to the Supreme Court, perhaps even next year. And that is a serious question that is about what the federal government is doing. You know, federal government says that for the purposes of federal law, marriage is going to be considered to be between a man and a woman, and that states, as you mentioned, do not have to respect marriages that are legal and valid in another state. And both of those propositions are extraordinarily constitutionally suspect, to say the least. And that's just in addition to the state case that you mentioned coming out of California, Perry versus Brown, which challenges Prop 8. And And that case can be seen as sort of the state version of the marriage equality case, whereas the DOMA cases are sort of about the federal government discriminating against gay and lesbian couples who want to assert their right to get married and raise a family. And I, my organization, Constitutional Accountability Center, filed a brief in the Perry case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out in San Francisco, arguing that, look, marriage equality is a fundamental right under the Equal Protection Clause and the text and history of the 14th Amendment. And this is one of those issues that, you know, with all due respect to the president, shouldn't be left to the states, that it's a fundamental right that's protected by the Constitution. And if your listeners want to look at our briefs, it's at theusconstitution.org, and we go through the text and history to show that.
Carrie, I want to turn to you. I know that the American Civil Liberties Union, while may not be lead on these cases, has certainly filed briefs in support of people who are challenging these anti-marriage statutes. What's the argument here? I mean, what's the argument? People say it's an equal protection clause issue. Why? What is it in the Constitution that gives gay people the right to marry?
Well, it's a pretty straightforward argument. It's that marriage is a fundamental right, and there's no rational basis for treating same-sex and opposite-sex couples differently. And in fact, to not treat them similarly is essentially illegal discrimination. And it's, you know, similar, you know, arguments have been made over the years on behalf of laws that used to apply different rules to men and women, whether it was insurance coverage or, you know, ability to work in different professions. And so a whole body of law has evolved around the equal protection theory, and their standard, the rational basis test, requires that the government be able to articulate a rational reason for why the laws don't treat similarly situated groups, you know, the same.
Now, didn't the court in the Ninth Circuit look at that very question? Didn't they ask the proponents of Proposal 8 to give a compelling reason for why these rights should be denied?
Yes, they did, and I think it turned into kind of a zoo. The experts for the plaintiff were not well prepared, and their arguments were based on stereotypes and bad data, and all of that was kind of revealed as that trial unfolded and the arguments unfolded.
Elizabeth, did the court actually say that there was no rational basis for this? It certainly came out in the course of the arguments. Was that part of the decision that came out of the district court?
Oh, yes. I think that it was really powerful that the district court gave a full trial to these issues. You know, I think a lot of us who strongly believe in the right to marriage equality, don't think that it merits so many days of trial court testimony to figure that out. But I thought it was really important that Judge Walker in the district court in California, you know, they had days of testimony, they had experts, and in his opinion, finding that Proposition 8 violated the Constitution, Judge Walker went through all of these various arguments and pointed out that they were totally irrational, from the idea that, oh, marriage needs to be between a man and a woman in case a woman gets accidentally pregnant and they need to have, these ridiculous arguments. He went through all of them and took them seriously and showed why they did not provide a rational basis for the law. And the Court of Appeals also aired those arguments. You know, the lawyers who argued before the Ninth Circuit were very good lawyers, and it was telling that the lawyer for the proponents of Proposition 8, who's a very good lawyer, was doing his good of a tap dance as he could to try to give some sort of rational reason for denying gay and lesbian men and women the right to their fundamental right to marry the person of their choosing, and he came up short.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, I want to ask you. You mentioned earlier about the ACLU getting involved in contraception issues early in the 20th century. As you look, there are a series of cases having to do with sexual privacy, marital relations, that Griswold v. Connecticut, for example, and then you move from there into the ability of single individuals to get contraception, which then moves us into lots of sexual autonomy issues. We get Roe v. Wade. Later we get Lawrence v. Texas with the anti-sodomy laws. Is this a case that is just waiting to become part of that line? In other words, is this a place where the court is going to have to go, and to stay true to precedent, or to the march there that those cases represent?
I mean, as you just beautifully laid it out, I think it is inevitable. It's just a matter of time, but let's remember how the Supreme Court has transformed over the years. And right now, I don't believe the votes are there for gay marriage. And so it is going to take a change in seats of at least one, if not more people, to create the forum, I think, where that decision can land. And so we're not there yet. And obviously the next president and who that person will appoint to that court is just absolutely critical.
Well, let me ask you this, and it's always uncomfortable to ask somebody to explain an opposing position, but to the best of your ability, what would hold members of the court back? In other words, is there a legal argument that would move justices to say, irrespective of my personal views, I think that constitutionally I have to vote no?
I don't think so. Elizabeth?
Elizabeth, what would be the argument that might be put forward as saying, you know, even though I think that, you know, people should be allowed to marry who they wish, that's not what the Constitution says?
Yeah, you know, I think that probably people would argue that it's a state issue. That is something that's up to the individual states. And that, you know, there's certainly been an argument that the states have traditionally been the ones to regulate marriage, to issue marriage licenses, et cetera. You get that from your state or local office, not from the federal government. But the problem with that argument is that even issues that have traditionally been left to the states, if they run up against something in the Constitution that gives a right against infringement against both the state and the federal government, like the right to equality, then it doesn't matter if the states, you know, so the states have traditionally regulated marriage, okay, but that did not stop the Supreme Court in a 1967 case, Loving versus
right.
Virginia, from saying that states cannot outlaw marriage between people of different races. That's a violation of the 14th Amendment. So, you know, I think there's an argument that one could make to the Supreme Court, but it's not a particularly good one. And I'm a little
right.
more optimistic,
and
I think, than Carrie.
I didn't mean to be glib about it, but I think you just kind of expanded on the idea that there aren't any very good legal arguments. There's the political strategy, right, which is saying that this is essentially should be decided state by state, which I just see as essentially a stalling technique to something that is inevitable and that does push, because of all the federal legal implications here for marriage, that pushes Congress, that pushes the Supreme Court at some point to take on this issue.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show. You're listening to us on 89.1 WEMU. We're talking about civil liberties, civil rights, federalism, particularly around the issues of gay marriage. And we're going to talk a little later about the Affordable Care Act. My guests today are Carrie Moss from the Michigan Civil Liberties Union and Elizabeth Wydra from the Constitutional Accountability Center. The issue of the court and the makeup of the court currently, Do you think this is a court that is going to stand firm on federalism? And I'm going to turn to you, Elizabeth. I mean, does this court have a doctrine? The Rehnquist doctrine, for example, was very strongly in favor of federalism. Is the Roberts Court in the same place, do you think?
I think it's not as sort of ideologically or theoretically consistent as the Rehnquist Court. You know, we talk about sort of the Rehnquist Court's return to federalism. And, you know, you have some justices on the court, like Chief Justice Roberts, who has in the past been a strong proponent of particularly executive power.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, a lot of court observers have sort of said, well, basically it seems to sort of depend on whether the court likes the policy that is being challenged or not. And that's a very frustrating position to be in when you're concerned that the court is going to rule not based on some coherent theory of federalism, but based on sort of, you know, do they want states to regulate drugs? Are they afraid of states having the power to say that medical marijuana is legal, as the court dealt with a few years ago? Or do they not like the individual mandate under the Health Care Act? You know, that shouldn't be what's determinative. It should be whether or not those particular policies fit within our constitutional ideals of federalism.
Well, Carrie, we just talked a minute about sort of the row of cases having to do with sexual autonomy and sexual privacy. The other